Welcome to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, a podcast produced by Procure with the goal of helping, supporting, and informing men at risk, newly diagnosed people, survivors, and their families. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. It is also the third leading cause of death, and in Quebec alone, 12 men a day are diagnosed with it. Yet, it is still a taboo subject for many. Procure podcasts are intended to be frank and transparent discussions with patients, caregivers, doctors, each with their personal stories and experiences with the disease. We hope that this tool will answer questions that you may not have dared to ask, and above all, will allow you to see that you are not alone. We remind you that Procure offers a 7-day-a-week telephone and online support service with nurses specialized in uro-oncology to answer your questions and concerns. We're here for you and your loved ones, so contact us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, our podcast series that I hope will answer some of your questions or concerns. I am Marie-Christine Beauchemin, your host from Procure. Today's theme, the role of the patient after a prostate cancer diagnosis, is particularly interesting as it highlights the importance for a patient to play an active role throughout their cancer experience. That is why, without further delay, I would like to welcome our guest, Dr. Daniel Lewinstein, surgeon uro-oncologist at the Hospital Charlemagne. Now, welcome and thank you, Dr. Lewinstein, for accepting our invitation to participate in this podcast.
My pleasure.
So let's start with discussing the role of the patient after receiving a diagnosis. As a urologist, what information do you typically provide to patients when they are diagnosed with prostate cancer?
So I think when you give them a diagnosis, obviously first there's the question whether it's a local disease or whether it's a metastatic disease, meaning there's disease outside the prostate. And that's important just so that the patient's aware. If it's a local disease, generally our goal is to cure the prostate cancer. Whereas if it's a disease that's outside the prostate in an extensive fashion, we're trying more to stop the prostate cancer. That's a kind of a big idea to present to the patients. Second is we're going to explain to them their treatment options. So we're going to talk about if it's, for instance, a low-grade cancer, would be Gleason 1 or Gleason group 2 favorable disease, we may consider doing active surveillance. Those patients, we would broach the topic of active surveillance. We explain to them how it's done and what is the interval of appointments with that. As well, we would talk about surgery as a treatment option and radiation as well as a treatment option. That includes brachytherapy, and those details would be further explained by the radiation oncologist if the patient elected to possibly consider radiation. So we would talk about the benefits and the side effects of the various different treatments. Also, we try, of course, to give the patient some idea of prognosis. It's very important for a patient that we know has local disease and we know is amenable to cure to clearly state that to them. Obviously, patients, when they come in, they're quite anxious, and it can be a big blow to patients to hear that they have a cancer. And so if we know and we think that we can cure these patients, it's very important to give them the message that, yes, there is something there, that entity, that disease is important, however, we have a solution to that problem. We also generally what we try to do is give them information that we know, and as well we often provide them with a book on prostate cancer. Here in Quebec, we have a book that was written by the Quebec Urologic Association that explains prostate cancer in detail, whether that be the physiology of the disease, the diagnosis, treatment options, prognosis. And generally, if we have a patient that is diagnosed on that time, that day zero, we'll give them a book. We'll explain to them the various treatment options. We may or may not ask for the staging test depending on the severity of the disease. And usually we would see that patient back in a couple weeks after they took the time to make a decision about treatment modality.
Once the patient is actually hearing all of this information that you've provided the person with, how can they actually participate in the decision-making of their treatment? And what is it that they need to consider? Now they've received the info from you, what do they, how do they process it? How should they process it?
So, yeah, I think they actually have to be made aware clearly about, response to treatment. So what is the oncological or the ability to cure the cancer of radiation versus surgery versus not doing anything? And I think we have to be honest with the patients, trying to give them some clear explanations of the data that has come out over the last 20 years with respect to cancer control. That's the main driver of, oncologic control and whether they'll have a recurrence or not and whether they'll be live or not at a certain time period. And of course, we want to explain to them the various possible side effects of the different treatments. So with surgery, you're obviously talking about having an intra-abdominal surgery. So there's risks that, may be conferred by any surgery, but specifically, what we talk about with a prostatectomy or having urinary issues, specifically incontinence, and having erectile issues, erectile dysfunction. We try to really be honest with the patients and give them the truth of, what their risk is of having those different side effects. So for instance, patients may read online from various centers of excellence that ED is really quite low, and they may, the majority of men will have good erections after surgery. And the answer is that's probably not true. If you look at third-party data, the majority of patients at that age of prostatectomy anyways don't have good erections, and the majority of patients after surgery will not have good erections. That being said, when we compare erectile functions at 5 years between surgery and radiation, they're identical, whereas in the acute period, erectile function is probably a little bit worse with surgery than radiation. That's most likely due to the fact that with radiation, the effect of it on the body does not occur right away, but rather a couple years later via the occlusion of arteries and loss of tissue. When we speak about urinary symptoms, we try to convey to the patients that, yes, it is a risk, but the majority of patients, over 90%, will have good continence at 3 months. Probably another 5, 7% will require pads, a couple pads a day. Probably about 1, 2% may require another procedure to rectify their severe incontinence, whether that be a bandelette or a sphincter to help them with severe incontinence. When we're speaking about radiation, things that we're talking about during the treatment, obviously patients are fatigued, but the majority of problems with radiation do not occur right away. They're more later problems, i.e. lifelong hematuria, having blood and urine, or lifelong bleeding from the rectum. It doesn't affect the majority of patients, and obviously with the years, radiation has become more and more targeted, so there's less collateral damage. That being said, there is still a percentage of patients that will have lifelong issues with that and may require transfusions and multiple procedures. As well, we mentioned to patients that have may consider radiation, there is a risk of having secondary cancers after radiation due to the cancer-inducing properties of the radiation itself, and that risk is around 1 to 3%. We also may mention to patients that if they do have radiation, that if there is a recurrence, it is not possible to have surgery after to salvage that disease. Whereas if the patient does have surgery and has recurrence, then we can do radiation after to salvage the disease. That being said, oncological outcomes between radiation and surgery are probably somewhat similar for the most of patients. However, younger patients, there is some data that younger patients under 65 may have less risk of late recurrence undergoing surgery with respect to irradiation. And so how do the patients get through all this heavy information, the extensive information? We try to convey to them what we know as urologic surgeons. We refer them to different websites, as I said before. Also, you know, we recommend to patients that if they know someone, whether that be a friend or a family member or a colleague that has undergone prostate cancer treatment, to discuss, if they feel comfortable with that person, discuss how they went through treatment, how their outcomes were, and whether they feel they recommend that treatment. That's quite helpful as well. And often patients will actually ask me, they'll say, I'm going to go talk to my family doctor, because when a patient meets you as a urologist, they just met you sometimes just maybe a month ago and you made a diagnosis quite rapidly, whereas they may know their family physician or their general practitioner for years. They may have a good rapport with that person, and that person may be able to sometimes give them some good information and steer them in one direction or another.
Do you have questions, concerns, worries? Contact us 7 days a week at 1-855-899-2873 to discuss confidentially with one of our nurses specializing in uro-oncology, who will take the time to listen to you and provide you with informed answers. The ProCure support team is there for you.
That's very good. Now, speaking of managing expectations, do you get questions from patients, particularly those with perhaps a little bit more advanced prostate cancer, about their survival in terms of years? You know, if you're giving me this treatment, if you're prescribing this treatment, how many years do I have ahead of me? And how do you manage these expectations when cancer is actually progressing?
So with respect to survival and recurrence, there's a couple of things. We can be completely honest with patients. You know, I think 20, 30 years ago, doctors would probably often say that we can't give you an exact number. You know, everyone is different. That is true. However, we can give patients a fairly accurate number nowadays, or probably above 80% accuracy of what the average patient, or what we call the median patient with his disease profile, will have as an outcome. So, you know, for instance, a patient that is undergoing radical treatment, whether that be surgery or radiation, we have excellent accurate tools based on thousands of patients having undergone those treatments with various risk factor profiles. We can give that patient a fairly accurate number as to what is their risk of recurrence at 5 years, what is their risk of recurrence at 2 years, what is their risk of mortality at 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years. That's with respect to definitive treatment for local disease, as well as patients that are receiving advanced agents, hormone manipulators or chemotherapy or other agents for advanced disease. We can give those patients a very accurate number of how many more months or how many more years does the treatment add on to standard of care? And at that point of the disease modality, what is your median survival? So a patient with metastatic disease may have 5 years, you know, let's say median to live. And if the patient asks us, we will give them that answer. And we will always use the caveat that, you know, all patients are different. And some patients may live less and some patients may live more. But if the questions are asked, we're able to give them fairly accurate answers with respect to survival and recurrence numbers.
If we stay in the survival mode for these types of patients, do you recommend clinical trials as part of the treatment options for them?
Definitely, we recommend clinical trials. The majority of time we will recommend a clinical trial, or often in the clinical setting of a setting where there are not good standard treatment options. So for instance, a patient that has local prostate cancer, you know, a standard disease, let's say Gleason 7 with a PSA of 10, you know, it's very clear that that patient needs radiation or surgery. However, a patient that has advanced disease that may is refractory to different lines of treatment, that would be the ideal treatment, ideal patient to elect to undergo a clinical trial as well. Of course, the patients have to be willing to deal with the clinical trial and the extensive number of meetings that person may have to have with the research team of that clinical trial.
All right. Now, we've talked about survival. We've talked about side effects. Now, how can patients proactively prepare themselves to reduce side effects after treatments? Let's start with standard treatment.
So I think, you know, the main side effects, you could talk about erectile function. So erectile function, you know, the factors that cause erectile function are age, which we cannot change, smoking, which we definitely can. So we, you know, would obviously suggest to patients to try to quit smoking. And then there's the standard risk factors for erectile dysfunction, which are the same as cardiovascular, so dyslipidemia, high blood pressure, diabetes. So those are all things that would be managed by the primary care physician or the internist of that patient. But we would highly recommend to them that they make sure that those things are under control to best control the factors that would cause more erectile dysfunction with respect to incontinence. So, you know, now we can suggest to patients that they even go see a physiotherapist pre-surgery so that they can reinforce their pelvic musculature to have better incontinence levels in the immediate post-op period. And as well, after the patient undergoes prostatectomy and their catheter is removed, those patients will be prescribed a consultation to see a physiotherapist rapidly to help with the rapidity of regaining continence. There are also other things that may be harder, such as losing weight. We know that, you know, the higher intra-abdominal size is going to cause more incontinence. So we may consider talking to the patients of having some type of intermittent fasting diet or having some type of protein-based diet just for a temporary period around the time of treatment to diminish incontinence.
And what about hormone therapy? So if we're getting into these types of treatments. So how can patients reduce the side effects?
So the main side effects of hormone therapy, so things we think about are, you know, loss of muscle mass, increased percentage of fat, loss of bone with subsequent fracture risk. And sometimes you can have fractures of the vertebral column, which can cause spinal compression. So things we think of there are, you know, obviously taking vitamin D and calcium to make sure the bones are strong. In patients that are on hormone therapy, we should actually be asking for bone densitometry exams. And in patients that have diminished bone density, so those that are osteopenic or those that are osteoporotic, obviously in conjunction with their family doctor, if they don't have them, we would do it on our own, is to start some type of agent to prevent bone destruction, such as a bisphosphonate or other. As well, we suggest to patients that are on hormonal manipulation, so LHRH agonists or antagonists, to do some type of weight-bearing exercises. We know that really helps strengthen the bones and reduces the risk of fracture. Patients, obviously, that are on longer periods of hormonal manipulation, so those that have advanced or metastatic disease, have more risk as time goes on. It's a cumulative risk, and that is conveyed to them. As well as the other side effects, we can consider things like cognitive changes. Obviously, cognitive changes may be due to the medication, and things to prevent is just to keep your brain active, to do whatever it is that will keep it moving, so i.e. reading, talking with people, talking with friends, talking with family members, maybe consider doing any type of activity where you need to use your brain, whether that's solving a puzzle or playing chess, anything essentially just to keep your mind moving, because if the mind is not being used, like any muscle, it's going to start to atrophy. Finally, of course, testosterone blockage does confer an increased risk of cardiac events. So either stroke or heart attack or peripheral embolic disease or thrombotic disease. So for that type of outcomes, clearly those things would be those the predictors of interest that were managed already by a family doctor or internist. So i.e. triglyceride levels, smoking, high blood pressure control, diabetes and sugar control, and obviously weight control for that. And then the other side effect patients do get are they get Buffet-Chalar, hot flashes. Mm-hmm. And for hot flashes, there isn't really anything special the patient themselves can do to stop the hot flashes. You know, they may consider putting on a cold compress or trying to use some techniques for relaxation. The best treatments for hot flashes are medical, but they do come with their own set of side effects. So we really try to avoid them as much as possible in the majority of patients that have hot flashes.
Now, how important are the follow-ups appointment? Do you feel that your patients are using these follow-up appointments with you to their advantage appropriately?
Yeah, I think, I think patients are becoming more and more informed. Obviously, the majority of people now obviously have access to the internet. They have access to information they might have otherwise not have had 20 years ago. They may not have personal experience, obviously, in treating prostate cancer, but they're well aware of the documentation out there, and they probably ask more questions today than they used to. And the more informed the patient is, probably the better care they're going to get. It's going to force you as the physician to think longer and harder about what you can do best for your patient. And as the patient themselves may sometimes bring things to the table that you may not even be aware of.
Now, what do you tell patients who want to use natural supplements during, before, during, or after treatments? In your opinion, is there any value?
You know, the majority of the supplements don't have good data to back up their utility. There were a couple of large trials about 15 years ago to look at the main prostate supplements, including Sol Palmetto. And in those agents at the time, when they actually evaluated them in large clinical trials, the positive effects that were seen in smaller, one-arm studies were not shown to be reproducible. We don't know of any agents that really do truly help prevent prostate cancer progression nor incidence. That being said, if patients want to use them, they can. But they have to be aware, obviously, that they have a cost and they don't have any proven benefit.
All right. We're coming to our last two questions. The first one, how important is a patient's attitude when diagnosed with prostate cancer?
I think attitude is everything. Obviously cancer is a very hard disease to deal with, and it requires a lot of strength. It requires a community, you know, patients that are better propped up, whether that be with a spouse or a partner or family or friends. Those are the patients that are going to do better to get through things because they probably have a better support system in place. And those patients that are positive, that feel like they're going to beat the disease and feel like things are going well, are certainly going to do better. These are, you know, logical things that we know, but there is data now, not necessarily in prostate cancer in itself, but in the majority of cancers, when they look at patients that are touched by cancer, patients that have a positive attitude that seem to feel like they're going to beat the disease seem to have better outcomes. Especially those that have the ability to interact outside, so patients that are doing exercise, patients that are patients that are doing exercise outside and have exposure to oxygen and have exposure to the sun and the environment seem to do better than those patients that don't.
Good. Where do you recommend patients find answers to their questions in between medical appointments and treatments?
So I think patients can access, the websites that are already available to them, such as in Canada, such as the CUA and the Procure websites. And when they have specific, more precise or individual questions, you know, they're able to call services that are available, such as Procure, which I know are available 7 days a week with health professionals that are well-versed in prostate cancer diagnosis and therapy and prognosis, and they would be best fitted to serve those patients that had more specific questions that might not be able to be answered on the internet itself.
Well, Dr. Daniel Lewinstein, thank you very much for sharing this insightful information with us. That wraps up today's podcast. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope this podcast has addressed some of your questions or concerns. Thank you, everyone, and see you next time. Again, Dr. Lewinstein, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Marie-Christine Beauchemin for Prostate Cancer Without Taboo.
Thank you for listening to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, a podcast produced by Procure. To learn more about prostate cancer and our podcast episodes, visit procure.ca.